Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. To understand that war, it really is important that we understand the wars that have preceded it. I would argue all part of the great continuum of this phenomenon I call the war for the free world. It began, arguably, with our revolution, and we have the opportunity to take stock of what that revolution entailed and what flowed from it, notably a constitution that we celebrate the anniversary of its enactment today, with a man who has had an extraordinary insight into various phases of this war, starting with the revolution, which he has captured in a marvelous book called Washington's Immortals. His name is Patrick K. O'Donnell, and he has agreed generously to give us a full hour of his time to talk about not only the revolution and what it immediately accomplished, but also tales of extraordinary heroism and what has been purchased with blood century upon century in earlier eras of this war for the free world. And we'll go through as many of these books, some 11 of them, as we can, and listen with rapt attention, I'm sure, to one of the great storytellers of our time. He is a combat historian, a man who has actually done some time in combat himself, reporting on some of the more recent exploits and sacrifices, notably during the attack in Fallujah by our men and women in uniform there in Iraq. But we'll cover a lot of ground with him in the process, I know, learn insights that are of tremendous importance, both in terms of where we've come from and where we're going. Patrick O'Donnell, it is a delight to welcome you to your first appearance here at Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you so much for doing it and for giving us so generously of your time.
Frank, it's really a pleasure and honor to be on the show with you today. And I'm very honored to talk about our nation's history and its importance today and in the past.
Yeah. Well, getting the past right is one of the challenges to the future, isn't it? You understand that so well. Let's talk a little bit about the Immortals. Again, one of the things that I think has been your stock in trade, if I can call it that, has been finding examples, personal or small unit examples of extraordinary heroism that really speak to and help the rest of us identify with the larger stories and accomplishments of those who have fought for this country, going back to the revolutionary time. But let's start with Washington's Immortals, please.
Sure. I mean, you put it beautifully. That each one of the stories that I tell in the books that I've written tell a larger story of America's history. And Washington's Immortals is not an exception to that. It's about the Maryland line, the men that were really Washington's shock troops. And they gained that notoriety first in the Battle of Brooklyn. And at Brooklyn in 1776, in the summer of 1776, all could have been lost. It was arguably one of our most important battles because the revolution would have been over had the British won, and Washington probably would have been captured. The army would have been destroyed had it not been for the efforts of many Americans, including Washington's Immortals. And this is the Marylanders that were in Brooklyn, and they basically fought an American Thermopylae, a small group of men also called the Maryland 400, charged multiple times into a house that was occupied by Cornwallis and allowed the American army to escape in a gap in the lines that they created. And they charged multiple times, and most of them were killed during the battle or on British prisoner of war ships. And for me, it's not a cliche to say that all the books that I've ever written have found me, and this is not an exception. I was in, it was 2010, the summer of 2010, and the battlefield commander who I had met in Fallujah asked me, "Pat, do you want to go to the Met or, you know, hang out in New York?" And I said, "Well, how about we do a battlefield tour of Brooklyn?" And that's really a special thing when you kind of walk the ground with somebody you'd fought with. And that's what we did. We went to, first we went to Prospect Park and Greenwood Cemetery. And this is where the battle begins. And we walked up and down the hills of Greenwood Cemetery. And this, for those who have not been to Greenwood Cemetery, it's in Brooklyn. And it's really an extraordinary cemetery because there are the, you know, the legends of New York City that are buried there, but it's also a battlefield. It's also the Battle of Brooklyn. We walked up and down sort of the hills of Greenwood, went through the alleys of Brooklyn, and came to an old house that's been recreated from the stones that were originally part of the house. And this is where the Marylanders had fought this Thermopylae and charged multiple times into the house. And literally, most of them were shot to atoms by British canister and musket fire. This is the flower of the South. Many of the families that were in the Maryland 400 or Washington's Immortals were some of the most, the wealthiest families in Baltimore and in Maryland. And they charged multiple times and allowed this gap in the line. And we walked a little bit further, a couple blocks further, and found a rusted old sign that said, "Here lie 256 Continental soldiers, Maryland heroes." Somewhere near there is the mass grave of these guys, and nobody has found it. And for me, I think that that is an incredible disgrace that they have not been found. I mean, considering we're able to find the remains of, you know, and rightfully so, of these heroes in Korea and you know, Southwest Pacific and New Guinea, et cetera. But we can't even find some of the greatest heroes in America that saved the United States in Brooklyn.
And this is really the key point in furtherance of that story. The providence that flowed from it, as I understand it, Patrick O'Donnell, was that as those troops were able to get through the line and get to boats that took them across the river to New York, they were shrouded in fog, which prevented the British from, you know, pursuing them and finishing the job. Is that right?
It's one of my favorite parts of the story. The John Glover's Marblehead men, these were experienced mariners from Marblehead, Massachusetts, and the area around it, were expert fishermen and sailors. They gathered all the boats that they could find in Manhattan. They brought the army over. But then the greatest act that they had performed that in that week was they brought them to safety.
It's such a fascinating story, and you bring it to life so well, Patrick O'Donnell, and we're going to ask you to do the same with subsequent events. We'll be right back with much more with best-selling author Patrick O'Donnell right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. Our guest is Patrick O'Donnell for this full hour. He is an extraordinary and accomplished combat historian, as well as a man who has contributed extraordinarily beyond his 11 best-selling books to films, to various mini-series and other television programs to bring to life the extraordinary history of our country's men and women in uniform, some of whom didn't wear a uniform at all, it turns out. Those who were spies and members of the OSS and the like in some of our storied combat situations but we'll come to that in due course. I did want to segue from your writings about the Revolutionary War to World War I. We are recognizing and celebrating, in a fashion, the centenary of that war. The United States was late to it, but played a decisive role in some of its most storied battles and how it all came out. Tell us about some of the examples of the exploits and the derring do of our military personnel that you feature in your newest book, Patrick, The Unknowns.
The Unknowns is about the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier and eight men that General Pershing had selected to bring back the remains. And these eight men were some of the most decorated enlisted men of the war. They had been in all of the major battles on land, but also at sea. And that's sort of an untold aspect of the American Expeditionary Forces in World War I. It also includes the story of Edward Younger, who was a sergeant, just a regular doughboy, that had been wounded very severely twice in combat. But Younger's role in the book was, and in history, was to select the unknown soldier. And what I found with this story is it's like Washington's Immortals, a completely, practically untold story. The tomb itself and it's the history behind it. And then these men were all kind of history in plain sight, and very few people had known anything about it. And I unearthed the story behind these body bearers. And it's not an episodic telling of the story in the book. It's a narrative of the entire AEF's experience in World War I, and it gives you an idea of what happened during the war. And as you mentioned, the Americans come late to the war, but they play a crucial role, not only in the battles themselves later on, but in terms of finances and natural resources. The Allies would have never been able to prevail in World War I had it not been for our contributions. But then later on, the American Army and also contributions by the Marine Corps play a decisive role in World War I. And it's these stories that are just so compelling. I found myself not really knowing a ton about World War I, but as I got into the research over several years, I just became obsessed and fascinated. I mean, just many of these men, what they had to undergo to survive, it's a book about survival in many cases, is extraordinary. Poison gas, where you had to literally live in your gas mask for hours upon hours, sleeping in it. And not only poison, mustard gas that irritated the skin that would, almost force you to take off the gas mask. High explosive artillery shells, Maxim machine guns,
trench warfare, the first use of aircraft in warfare to bomb and the like. I mean, these are transformative technologies that made that war one of the most horrific in history. And the extent to which these doughboys and Marines and airmen and sailors made a decisive impact in it is again something that you capture brilliantly in this very moving account of the story of the unknown, and how those who were recognized as his, well, pallbearers, I guess you'd say, were all contributors to that important victory. Let me pivot, if I can, because there's so much to cover with you, Patrick O'Donnell. So many stories, so many insights into our nation's history as it was really fashioned, saved, and certainly made us the country we are today. By turning to World War II, and you've written most of your books about one aspect or another of that war, and I thought we might start with sort of the tales from a decisive moment in it, D-Day. And the boys of Pointe du Hoc, as President Reagan famously put it in his memorializing of them at the Normandy Cemetery when he was president. Tell us about Dog Company and the role that it played in that particular battle.
Dog Company is really the first band of brothers on the Rangers in World War II. but it covers Dog Company, the men that scaled the 90-foot cliffs at Point Tahaka under machine gun fire, grenade fire. There were IEDs that were actually hung. There were old artillery shells that were hung from the face of the cliff. These men had to endure arguably the toughest objective of D-Day, to take out, to not only scale these cliffs, but also fight through a bunker maze of entrenchments on top of the cliff, and then somehow find the large guns that threatened both Omaha and Utah Beach, as well as the ships that were the naval ships that were coming ashore with our men. This is an incredibly dangerous mission. They bombed Point Tahaka. It was the most heavily bombed objective of D-Day. They made it the crater of the moon, but they still weren't able to take out the guns, which they were not in the casemates on top of the cliff. They were towed about nearly a mile inland into an orchard, and they were placed under nets. But Dog Company captures the main characters of that company, and who were many of them were my close friends, like Leonard Lamel. And these men I had interviewed in the 90s, most of them, and then later on when the 2000s.
And let me just interrupt you on that, because it's so important to talk about your technique, really, which is very much focused on these oral histories and the firsthand accounts of the men who actually performed these heroics. It's not just from, you know, secondhand sources. You're going to the most primary of some sources, are you not?
On all of the books that I've ever written, it's mainly all primary research. Like, for instance, Washington's Immortals has 58 pages of endnotes, and most of them are primary sources, pension files, diaries, letters that have never been seen. And Dog Company is not an exception there. These were mostly oral histories that I had conducted with these men, and then I triangulated them with the other men that were in the unit, as well as with the official after-action reports that were out there, to get a total kind of view of what it was like to be a ranger that had to scale this cliff. And it's not only scale the cliff, but they had to fight on top of the cliff with kind of the guns of Navarone. These bunkers, there were tunnels, there were bunkers that had high-caliber artillery fire that were direct on these men. They had, you know, machine guns all over the place that the Germans were employing.
Heavily defended, to say the least. And this maze of things that they had to fight their way through to get to their objective. It's actually a miracle that they were able to accomplish the mission.
And then they take the guns out using what's known as a thermite grenade. And it's basically, it melted the gears on several of these guns. And then they smashed the sights with their Tommy guns. Leonard Lamel, actually, one individual did this. And the story that most people, that they think that that's the end of the story. But the reality is the Germans counterattacked for 2 days and nearly overran the hill, the point. And I mean, they were attacking in nearly battalion strength, and they almost ran the Rangers into the sea. It's an incredible story of these men were so desperate that they were using MG-42s, captured MG-42s, and captured German weapons, anything that they can get their hands on to stave off a defeat. And it's an extraordinary story of American exceptionalism.
And again, why it's so important is that, to some extent at least, the whole D-Day enterprise turned on whether those guns were neutralized and that high ground remained in the hands of American forces. And you, again, capture it brilliantly, Patrick O'Donnell, in Dog Company. We're going to have to pause here for just a moment shortly, but I did want to just introduce this other sort of leitmotif of a number of your books about World War II, and that is that there were people who were not fighting with our regular forces, but were playing an instrumental role in their success. And just very briefly, introduce us to this organization known as the OSS.
The Office of Strategic Services. This is Wild Bill Donovan's organization. And this is one of the most extraordinary organizations ever created. It was created nearly overnight in 1941, where it was first known as the Coordinator of Information. And Wild Bill Donovan had to create a national intelligence organization with hardly any resources. But the other part of the story that most people have no clue, this is also America's, the foundation for America's modern special operations forces. This is the formation of the operational groups and the JITBERCs, which were the direct forerunners of the U.S. Army Green Berets, the maritime units, which was the precursor to the U.S. Navy SEALs, where they developed the rebreather, for instance, and all the equipment that went around it, the first so-called SEAL teams. All of this stuff was done by the OSS decades ahead of its time.
And under extreme necessity. Hey, we have to pause, and Patrick O'Donnell will be back with more on his book, Operatives, Spies, and Saboteurs, and much more as we delve deeper into how this extraordinary feat of winning World War II was accomplished by our men and women, both in uniform and out, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're talking to one of the country's extraordinary writers, creative talents, and raconteurs, specifically about the combat history of the United States from its, well, before its founding, actually, right up to the present moment. He is Patrick K. O'Donnell. He has authored some 11, usually best-selling, always highly acclaimed books on various aspects of the nation's combat and special operations and espionage activities over the course of our nation's history, indeed, that have made that history possible in important respects. And we've been visiting with him about the founding of our republic. Here we are on Constitution Day with Washington's immortals playing a leading role in making it possible. We've talked a little bit about World War I and the exploits of the men who helped decide that horrific war. And now we've been visiting with him a little bit about the extraordinary service provided to our country by Rangers and the OSS. And I wanted just to use this block of the program, Patrick, to give you the broadest of canvases to flesh out, as you have with numerous books. We mentioned Operative Spies and Saboteurs. You have the Brenner Assignment. You have the First Seals. You have They Dared Return, about Jewish spies, Beyond Valor, sort of capturing the big picture of Europe and combat in the Pacific in your Into the Rising Sun. I just want you to run with it. Tell us the story of World War II, as you do better than just about anybody.
Thank you very much for that compliment. It's been an honor to just tell the stories, many of them untold, of these exceptional American heroes. And my favorite World War II story is probably the Brenner Assignment. And this is a story about Stephen Hall, who is a dropout of Harvard and Yale. And he has an incredibly interesting and kind of eclectic life. He's a circus show, literally goes into the ring and fights the tough guy and gets knocked out. He's a wildcatter. But in 1938, before the war begins, he skis around the Brenner Pass and mountain climbs that area. He's a fairly wealthy guy. And he finds that's his true passion is skiing and mountain climbing. And then as World War II begins, he volunteers for the combat engineers and is taking a long train ride from Washington, D.C. to Washington State. And on that train ride, he pens a letter to the OSS saying that if you drop me, a one-man team with explosives and skis and mountain climbing equipment, I can disable the sub-passes that feed into the Brenner Pass. And the Brenner Pass in World War II is kind of the main supply line or artery that feeds German forces from the Reich into Italy. And if you could cut it or sever it, you could cut much of the reinforcements and troops that were feeding, the Third Reich was feeding into Italy for the war effort. And he writes this letter and is given this impossible mission. It's practically a suicide mission. and he jumps in by behind the lines by parachute. And Stephen Hall, who's this kind of waspy, blue-blooded guy, finds himself in the mix of Italian partisans that are largely communist and doesn't fit in at all. And he also has to deal with these mountain peaks. Some of the most beautiful country in the world is in the Dolomite Mountains. And he's marching and fighting. He's fighting the SS. He's literally, at every turn, he's avoiding the SS who are hunting him in these mountains, and also trying to stay alive from these Italian partisans who really don't understand him, don't necessarily like him either. And within this story, it's a story about his understanding of himself. He writes a diary, a daily diary that I uncovered, and he buries it in a wine bottle on the side of a house in the Italian Dolomites. And in the midst of all this, he falls in love with a German, effectively a mayor of a town, but she's a French double agent. It's extraordinary.
Wow. It sounds like fiction, and that's the greatest thing about your books, is that they do sound like fiction, and yet they really are the truth.
This is 10,000 documents that were part of War Crimes Case 36. And why it was War Crimes Case 36 is Stephen Hall was executed by the SS. But before that occurs, he falls in love with this beautiful mayor of the town, who's also this French double agent, and he tries to take out a train station near the Brenner and is captured. But before that occurs, the OSS tries to save Stephen Hall and bring in a team to rescue him and also augment his capabilities. And if you've ever seen the movie Gangster Squad, and this is after the war, the precursor to the DEA and other elements of the U.S. government try to take out Mickey Cohen's crime organization in California. But anyways, the person they really went after, they used to go after him, was Howard Chapel. And Howard Chapel was one of the greatest OSS operatives that created the German operational teams. These were precursors to Green Berets, and his men were kind of a dirty dozen of former, many of them were former, they escaped Nazi Germany. They were Jewish. They all spoke German, but they were just an incredible group. And Chapel leads a small team to find Hall, and he parachutes in. And almost immediately, he's hit with what's known as a rastrellamento. And this is where the SS would take a battalion or two off the line, the main line, and they would do sweeps to the countryside. And his safe house was overrun by the SS. And it's an incredible story of survival. He literally has to, they have a BAR, and they fight with the BAR. One guy gets killed. And they run down the creek. And many of these men literally cover themselves in mud to avoid the SS. And Chapel gets into hand-to-hand combat. To make a long story short, Chapel finds the wine bottle and Steve's diary, and then he goes after the men. He basically escapes the SS, reconstitutes his partisan unit, and they set up in a place called Caprile. It's a small Italian town near the Brenner. And they set up in high ground with his partisans. And they were able to destroy a bridge that's a crucial exit to the Brenner. And they stop about 4,500 SS troops combined with the 501 Tiger heavy tank battalion, which is trying to escape. And Chapel, with his partisans, seals off this exit plan. And then it's an extraordinary thing. He goes in with a white flag because the SS had taken all the Italians in the area and put them in a church and told them that they would blow the church up if they didn't let them pass. Chapel went in with a white flag single-handedly. All he had was on his side was a 45 in the white flag, and said, "Look, you need to surrender because we have a parachute battalion that just landed. You're surrounded, and we're going to annihilate you." The SS major, who had killed Hall or had a hand in killing Hall, said to Chapel, "You're my prisoner. And Chappell said, no, that's not going to work that way. And he said he eventually convinces the SS major to surrender his forces and then says, well, you'll at least treat me the way I treat your men, right? And Chappell says, absolutely.
Understanding full well how he had treated Hall. This is such an extraordinary story, and it just gives the listener, I'm sure, a sense of what the fuller recounting of these tales by you is.
That flag is still in the church in northern Italy.
No
that
kidding.
Saved all those men, that white flag.
No kidding. How fantastic. So just to, again, back the lens up just a little bit. The stories that you recount of, as I say, everybody from special operations forces to these Jewish spies who returned to Germany under the most dangerous of circumstances, obviously, to the tales of derring do in combat in Europe and in the Pacific, notably in Beyond Valor and Into the Rising Sun, respectively, are the sorts of things that bring to life Patrick O'Donnell, the fact that these were epic moments in American history and in the history of, well, the free world, as I think of it, too. Tell us just one example from your Tales of the Pacific, if you would, about how, again, the battles turned on the individual heroism of some great Americans.
I think you really hit the nail on the head. I mean, this is a situation where these are, in many cases, inflection points in history, and they turn on a single or a small group of individuals that are willing to risk it all. That's what you could boil down many of my books into. It's they're mostly untold stories, little known stories that tell a larger story of World War II or the Revolution or the Korean War. And in the Pacific, there's many, many extraordinary stories of how. For instance, one of my favorite aspects of Into the Rising Sun, that's my Pacific War book, I interviewed about 4,000 veterans from World War One, maybe it probably amounts to more, from World War One all the way through Iraq and Afghanistan. But the bulk of those interviews were in World War II veterans who, sadly are now, many of these men were my close friends, have now passed.
We have to pause. It is so important to get the full flavor of these tales that you're telling, Patrick O'Donnell, and I really commend to our listeners your myriad 11 best-selling books. We'll be right back with our final segment with Patrick K. O'Donnell right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Okay, we're back for the final installment. We've hardly scratched the surface, it's obvious, with Patrick K. O'Donnell about his life's work, which has been chronicling these amazing stories of American men and women who have served their country under some of the most dangerous of circumstances and in the process won our freedom and protected it for future generations. I did want to turn quickly, Patrick, with you to the Forgotten War, as it's often called, Korea. You have done an extraordinary job of describing another of these, well, small units, George Company in this case, that played an outsized role in a critical fight, this one at the Chosin Reservoir in North Korea. Give us a short course on that and the way that it contributed to the ultimate outcome of that Korean conflict.
This is November, late November, 1950, and the Chinese had basically crept across the Yalu River in mass. There were hundreds of thousands of Chinese soldiers that had crept across.
But just to set this up a little bit, American forces had landed at Incheon in a surprise flanking maneuver, driven the North Koreans all the way up basically to the Yalu River, and suddenly faced these hundreds of thousands of Chinese coming into the war, sneaking across the Yalu. Pick that up, if you will.
And the basically, the Marine Corps were part of what was known as 10th Corps, and this included the Army. It landed on the, if you're looking at Korea, on the right side of Korea, and they were moving up towards the Yalu. But they were moving in an area called the Chosin Reservoir. And this is some of the most mountainous terrain in North Korea. Very sharp passes that have, in some cases, mile-deep gorges. These men marched and fought
in miserable weather.
And the weather is an incredible story, too. It was some of the coldest in history. These men were fighting in 30 below zero weather. And then if you add the wind chill in, it would go down to about 60 to 70 below zero with outdated equipment from World War II. They were completely unprepared for a winter war. And they were in the Chosin area, and they were surrounded by the Chinese army. In many cases, it was 20 to 1 odds that they were facing. And George Company is the small unit that literally, it's one of the few units that's, they didn't have enough trucks to bring them into the Chosin initially. So they were left behind. But this is where they play a crucial role. They literally have to break into the Chosin Reservoir, into an area called, they have to go down an 11-mile stretch of road called Hellfire Valley. An entire Chinese division had the high ground astride this road. And the unit had to fight through that. And what makes the story so interesting is these men were known as reservists. But in 1950, reservists didn't have any boot camp for the most part. Many of these men didn't know how to fire a grenade or throw a grenade. They learned on the ship on the way over. They learned, literally were doing target practice on board the ship and learning everything. And they were learning from experienced NCOs, including a guy by the name of Rocco Zullo, who's sort of the main character of George Company. And Zullo is this tough, he's from Vermont. He's a logger. And but in World War II, he had fought on the Matanikau River. He had fought near Henderson Field, received a Silver Star lapel loop. But he had to whip these guys into shape and somehow get this unit up to snuff. And he does it miraculously. But on Hellfire Valley, he's on a truck. It's a long column of trucks and men that have to somehow go down this 11-mile stretch. And he's on a 50 caliber on this truck. There's a few tanks in the front, but then the column is made up of cooks and bakers, anybody that they could, any warm body that they could find. Because the war hung in the balance, they had to break through to a place called Hagaruri, which was an outpost on the other side of Hellfire Valley. And the Chinese had surrounded it. And they needed every possible reinforcement that they could find. And they marched down this road, and they were taking tremendous casualties. The Chinese had cut this long convoy of trucks and tanks. The whole back column was annihilated. They had about 50 or 60, 70% casualties. But George Company and Zullo were in the front, and Zullo was on a 50 caliber machine gun, just mowing people down. And they got to the front of the column, got to the gates of Hagaruri, which is this Marine outpost. And all of a sudden, these Marines kind of came out. And Zullo was then shot by what he thought was a Marine, but they were actually Chinese soldiers dressed as Marines. They had taken our uniforms. His entire side was blown out by a rifle fire, and he was placed on a pile of bodies about 6 or 7 feet high and left for dead. And the men then pushed up towards East Hill, which was the critical hill that was over Hagaruri. It was the high ground that the Chinese desperately wanted. They get up there just in time. They take the hill and they hold it against all odds. You know, 20 to 1 odds or more are attacking the hill. They're using, you know, M1919 Browning machine guns, all belt fed stuff, just to fend off the Chinese. And this is the middle of snowstorms. 40 below zero weather. They don't have any food. The only thing that they're able to get is these Tootsie Rolls, believe it or not. And the men survive on Tootsie Rolls. That's all they have for food. It's snow. But what's so extraordinary is they're building an airfield with the time that they that they're able to buy from George Company, and they build the airfields and bring in reinforcements. But what's interesting is that Zulo, somebody from another unit, finds him on top of this pile. They hear a cough about 8 hours later after he was put there, and they bring him into a field hospital and evacuate him. Nobody in George Company knows that he's alive for 40 years until their first reunion. And they then meet in the 1980s, and into the room comes the ghost, Rocco Zulo. And everybody's like, well, Rocco died on November 30th, 1950.
Not so. Hey, listen, very quickly, we're going to run out of time here well before we run out of accounts of your own experiences, let alone those of our fighting men and women. I did want to just ask you quickly, you were embedded yourself with Marines in the course of the battle for Fallujah, the subject of your book, We Were One. And we won't have time to do anything remotely like justice to it, but I did want to commend it to our listeners, because there are among us today heroes as well, people who have paid the ultimate sacrifice in some cases, but others who worked with them, who are even now making possible the perpetuation of our participation in this free world, and thereby a lot of others as well. And at the risk of skipping that important story altogether, I did want to just ask you, Patrick O'Donnell, if you could, in 2 minutes, sort of synthesize the main takeaways from all of these books of yours and all of your oral histories and insights as to what makes people fight for this country, and what difference does it make that they do?
For me, the Fallujah is seared in my brain like a branding iron. I was in the platoon that had suffered the most casualties, and We Were One is about 8 best friends, and only 3 survive Iraq. The rest are killed, and the platoon is nearly decimated from many of the men received 1 or 2 Purple Hearts from some of the most intense urban combat since Way City. I just was impressed by what I saw there on how these just average Americans kept going against all odds. In many cases, they were outnumbered by jihadists, or the jihadists were foreign fighters from 18 different countries, and many of these individuals were on crystal or liquid methadone, fighting like madmen, even when they were buried under rubble. I guess the common takeaways is that, you know, I saw it in Fallujah. You see it in the Washington's Immortals. You see it in We Were One and Give Me Tomorrow, the Brenner Assignment. Each generation of Americans is a great generation in its own way.
Patrick O'Donnell, this is only just begun scratching an itch. I hope we'll have a chance to go at again with you in the very near future. This has been such fun, and your passion for our country and those who serve it is extraordinary, and I hope that you will continue to keep up the good work. We will be back with much more on tomorrow's program. I hope you'll join us at the same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.